Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story It's Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Oh boy. Yes, this is episode 168, and we're going to talk about Dracula by Bram Stoker. Bram or Bram?
I think it's Bram because his name was Abraham.
That's right. His name was Abraham Stoker. That's
and I don't
true.
Think the Irish say it that differently.
That's right. And he was Irish, wasn't he?
Yes.
Excellent. Yes.
Yeah.
So this is one of your very favorite books of all time, is it not?
It really is. And it's funny because when I was young, so maybe junior high, I read it at least once a year for years.
Oh, wow. So this is Lord of the Rings territory.
Well, I'd like to say that, but I wasn't a very deep reader. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what it was that attracted me to it. And my mom finally at one point went, "This is ghoulish. Why do you keep rereading this book?" And she understood rereading. Mm. It's just she didn't understand why this book. And then I've mentioned it so many times before, but Corey Olson at Mythgard Academy did one of his free classes on Dracula, saying it was one of his favorite books. And you know how it is when you have a good teacher, they start opening things up and you go, "Oh my gosh, there's so much more here than I realized." And then, of course, doing what we do here,
mm-hmm.
the more you read things with that kind of a mindset, the more you see things opening up. And so what I realized is instead of just being an old piece of horror fiction, it is meticulously crafted and really well put together. Just like a jigsaw puzzle.
I completely agree. Yeah. So I read it, and I'm going to say this time, but I'm wondering if I really had read it before. Because though there were a heck of a lot of pieces that were very familiar to me, the thing as a whole was really excellent in a way that I do not recall. So if I had read it, it was a very superficial reading.
Mm-hmm.
This time, wow. I mean, I just couldn't wait to get back to it. And, I was surprised also that it was 400 pages for some reason I thought it was like a half that, you know, so I'm wondering if what I read was some kind of an abridgment at some point in my life or something.
Yeah.
Very possibly. So, but this is again, you know, yet again, as happens time and time again on this podcast, this is like one of those, you know, source documents, you know, quote unquote, where you read it and suddenly so many other things now make more sense that have sort of spawned from here. And I'm imagining that in turn, you know, Stoker was, you know, he was creating something that was spawned from something else as well. But it's deeply mythic and, I just thought it was terrific. Really, really, really excellent. Another one that I'm thrilled to have read.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Well, and the hard part is we think we know it. We don't think we need to read this book again because everybody knows about Dracula. You know, we've had zillion movies, so many books, TV shows. And what's interesting to look at in our time anyway, because I haven't studied how it was done in, you know, previous decades, but is to see what people do with the vampires. I mean, I remember a TV show, and I can't remember the name of it. It was short-lived, but it was somebody who'd been maybe a police detective, and he got turned into a vampire, and he spent all his spare time trying to figure out how to get turned back because he couldn't feel anything anymore.
Hmm.
Well, you know, that's a noble, wonderful thing. You don't want to be like that. And that's kind of how we've kind of turned the vampire into, it can be evil, but it can also be a sympathetic character like the Twilight books, which I haven't read, so I don't know. But, you know, capable of good and of love and all this kind of thing. And that's the power of that particular story because what Bram Stoker, I believe, was doing was taking old folk tales and myths and then spinning them into something new. I found a page, and I think it's called Bela Lugosi blog. We'll have to put the link up.
Yeah.
But it has a page that has all the contemporary reviews of Dracula.
Yeah, you sent me that, and I found them. They were so fun to read, so thanks for sending that. But yeah, to read that, you know, so without the context of all of the pop culture stuff that we have right now.
Right.
So those lenses are gone, and to have people, you know, we're talking about 1897.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking here.
Yeah, whenever it came out.
The original publication date was 1897.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was neat.
Yeah, because I would say about 3/4 of them were very positive. Mm-hmm. And there was the 1/4. And so this is like any popular book. You know, there are always people going, ugh, this is disgusting. I know he did something neat, but no,
right.
He did not. This is terrible. But the rest of them were going, holy crow.
Yeah.
Look at what he did. He took all these ancient myths, so they didn't act as if they'd never heard of a vampire before.
Mm.
But he made them so modern and fresh. And I've always read that one of the charms of the book at the time was that everything that's being used in here, and there's a lot of technology. There's somebody who's making his diary on a phonograph record. There is blood transfusion. There are all these things that we take for granted, but that at the time were cutting edge or even experimental. So then what you realize is this book at that time was like, I don't know, the X-Files, or which in itself is an outdated reference. But, you know, all this stuff we have, the Harry Dresden books, the Night Watch series that we read the first one of, where they're taking something really old, although a newer version of it from things like Dracula, and repurposing it in our modern world. And that's what he did here.
Yeah,
so he's saying something about the modern world as well as about vampires.
Right. You know, when you're saying that, I'm thinking Van Helsing. And that's an interesting character as well, because not only is he scientific, but he's also believes in legends and things.
Right.
So, you know, when he comes in and somebody's having a problem, he's like, I think I know what that is. You know, and yet, well, it's Dr. Seward who's recording his voice on the phonograph, but,
but
that's neat. So it's like technology, technology and religion next to each other all throughout.
Yeah. It's kind of doing what we do, where it's, are you willing to keep your mind open to both things, or have you set what's going on? And because, and we can do a brief recap of the book actually, but, one of the things that's getting looked at here is, what are you willing to throw out because you'll only look at things with a modern mindset? I mean, when the book starts, it's being told through Jonathan Harker's diary. And the entire book is, I don't know if it's not just letters, if it's called epistolary, but it's all told through people's diaries, journals, letters. And so, and that they've been carefully put in order, as they say at the beginning of the book. So you don't have to worry about why that was, which I thought was a really interesting note. So it's as if it was a real thing. And they're like, oh, we put it all in order. Don't worry. You'll find out about it. And but Jonathan Harker is, he's going to go visit this count because his law firm needs him to sign some papers, and he's working on some stuff for him. And he's charmed by how quaint and old-fashioned everything is. Oh, I must get this recipe from Mina. Oh, look at the costumes. Oh, we had this thing called paprikash. Wow, I had to drink so much water. And he's the epitome of the sophisticated big city guy who's out there with the quaint folk.
Yeah, that's one of the things I noted in that first little section was how he described his food. I remember two times where he was like very explicitly, check this out. Yeah. And then there's like note to self, you know, I must grab this recipe. And I thought, well, how interesting is that?
I know, because he was just being a tourist, you know, and he soon finds that these old superstitious people kind of know what they're talking about. And through the entire book, we are shown time and again the contrast between the simple folk, so to speak, and the elite. And the simple folk and their superstitions and the fact that they're just looking at what's going on around them are almost always right. And the elite are busy putting their layers of knowledge on top of everything and discounting everything that doesn't fit in.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's a really neat observation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, today we have, you know, the the elitist bubble or whatever, people say, you know, yeah, you're not living in the real life because you, you know, like a politician or somebody that somebody's talking about that, you know, you don't understand what the real problems are. You know, you're right up there on your castle and you're solving problems that we don't even have. It's the same thing when you mentioned that, that's what I thought of. It's like, oh wow. So they're like living in reality, seeing reality, and they're like reacting to what they're actually encountering. And, the people that are rich and, well-to-do are not, experiencing those same things. So this is all like brand new.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a wisdom in that, right? It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's that idea, and this is one of the things that makes Van Helsing interesting, because he is a man of science, but he's also religious,
mm-hmm.
and he has a speech that's really great. I probably won't be able to find it, but where he talks about, you know, we have all these myths, and the people of science don't even want to think about it, but there's a reason all these tales have come down to us so long.
Mm.
You know, they get passed on from person to person because they're practical and they work.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is, I'll send a link also. There's a great article at Blackgate blog,
mm-hmm.
where they talk about one of the things that Stoker is doing here is pointing out that there's this supernatural reality that once you become too educated and too sophisticated, you just ignore it. And the people who are proven correct are Dracula and Van Helsing. They're the ones who know that here are the basic realities of life and all the things that everybody else calls superstition, you know, drinking blood and
you know, I mean, no, that's so cool, because it's like, it's even, you know, there's this bigger point that when you start to ignore it, you know, it gets around much easier. You know what I mean?
Right.
Dracula is able to move because people don't know that he exists.
Exactly. And
they don't believe it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Jonathan Harker goes crazy for a little while. He has brain fever.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself is like, well, you can read this thing, but don't ever tell me you read it because I can't think about it again. He went through it and he doesn't know if he can believe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
He doesn't believe it until he sees the Count in London.
Is brain fever something I can call in for at work? Just adding that to the list of things. Yeah. List of possibilities. Yeah. But I really love the scene, you know, where Harker is, he's staying with some people, and then he's like, well, I got to go up to that castle now. And they're like, no, don't you dare go.
Oh,
and then he finally says, you know, hey, I've got to go do my duty. This is what I do for a living, you know. I'm going to go up there. And then she gives him a crucifix, this lady.
A rosary, yeah.
Yeah, a rosary, right. And it's
crucifix on it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I thought, well, that's cool. And he's like, well, you know, these, you know, he was a Protestant of some type or whatever.
The Anglican,
he's
like, I think.
Yeah,
if he even believed that.
Yeah, he was like, I don't really believe in this stuff, but hey, thanks.
It's like, well, I didn't want to hurt her feelings. And then later, and he's kind of going, I don't know. I know she gave it to me, but I don't really believe in this stuff. And I know my church doesn't think this stuff is great. It must be Catholic.
Yeah.
And then later he's like, oh, God bless that dear old woman for putting that around my neck. Oh, you know, and so it's that thing.
I feel actually marked that. Bless that good, good woman who hung the crucifix around my neck.
Yeah.
For it is a comfort and a strength to me whenever I touch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So early on, mm-hmm. we're seeing it's not a cross because his church doesn't have that stuff. It's a crucifix.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what we also see, though, is the whole way through up to then, he's like, ugh. He's just like people today.
Mm.
You know, the people who have like
busy, faith. Yeah.
And say, there might be something to what I'm thinking. He's like, you can't prove that. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. We have a religion, but let's hold it together, people.
That's right. That is another excellent point. Wow. Yeah, that's neat.
Well, this book is just so, it applies to modernity in so many ways. And I just, it's so funny to listen to people that have a more modern mindset talk about it. They get all the main points, but I don't think they see themselves in it. And I know that when I talk to people like that, and we can be friends and everything, but I'm viewed, and you probably too, as more of a Van Helsing, like kind of a kook, you know?
Oh, that I were Van Helsing, yeah.
Yes, with better grammar.
I think yeah. People look at me more like Renfield than Van Helsing.
Oh, no. The do-it-yourself eternal life.
Exactly.
I got my DIY going on over here. I know the blood is life. I feel like I can do this.
That is too funny. Renfield,
well,
yeah.
So everybody knows the story, and I don't want to tell too much of the story because there are a surprising number of twists, I think.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
So, essentially, as we said, Jonathan Harker is, you know, a young lawyer's assistant, legal assistant, and he's going out to do some work because his boss is too old and maybe ill to do this. And his very important client is this Count Dracula. And he goes through all the towns that get him further and further away from what he calls civilization, and actually is civilization. And he winds up on a mysterious carriage ride and then at this castle where he never sees the servants. The count's always gone all day. He has to stay up almost all night talking to the count because he has such odd hours.
One thing there too, in contrast to the food thing, is the count never eats.
That's right.
You know, the count gives him food, but he watches him eat. He doesn't partake himself.
He can roast a
great...
Which is
a contrast to Harker writing his, hey, look what I'm eating, you know, taking his iPhone photos of the food.
I fell upon a delicious roast chicken.
Wow, it's like I have this idea now for a Dracula movie that comes at it from the angles that you've talked about already. Completely and in modern, right?
Yeah.
With iPhones and everything.
Yeah, exactly. But that would be faithful to the book.
Exactly.
I mean, because every time they do a modern one, it seems like they like to read back into it some modern stuff. And
right.
We can talk about that later. So anyway.
How interesting,
What eventually happens is that he realizes, oh, well, that's interesting. Everything's locked. I'm a prisoner. There is no one here but me and Dracula. He's actually pretending to be the servants. He's been pumping me about this house that we bought for him. And if you can have more than one lawyer and all these details about living in London. And then he has an adventure that shows him exactly how horrible the count is and his fellow vampires who are there. And he's like, oh, my gosh, he's going to London. He's going to do this in London. Oh, no. And that's the other twist, is all the old myths. You know, it was out in the countryside and the poor peasants. But see, what Bram Stoker does is he brings it into the modern world. It's like, here I am in New York City or L.A. or whatever, which is common to think about now. But at the time, nobody did.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then this part of the story ends and we start seeing letters between Mina, his fiance, and her great best friend, Lucy Westenra. And so Mina eventually goes to stay with Lucy for kind of a holiday while she's waiting for Jonathan to come back or communicate with her because she's afraid he's dead. And we also don't know what happened to him. And then mysterious things start happening in the town that they're in. And Lucy starts acting stranger and stranger and stranger. And luckily for Lucy, she had three different suitors who all wanted to marry her, only one of whom she was in love with. And they kind of band together and bring in this expert that one of them knows since he's a doctor of the local lunatic asylum. he brings Dr. Seward. He brings in his old teacher, Van Helsing, and to start investigating, why is Lucy so sick? She's so pale. And there's no reason for it. She's so tired all the time. She can't breathe. And Van Helsing takes one look and goes, oh, crap. This is the thing.
Yes.
But he doesn't tell anyone what the thing is because he knows he's in modern London and no one's going to believe him. And then things happen.
Yeah, yeah.
That's out to prove it to Dr. Seward, who, despite the evidence of his own eyes, and I sympathize, still the next morning is like, I don't think I really saw what I thought I saw. Continually, he's doing that modern mindset.
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually what happens is everybody bands together because of their various tenuous links to each other through friendship and experience and trying to track down what's going on. And they wind up realizing we are the only ones here who know what's going on, and we have to stop Dracula because they've seen him. He's around. He's in London now.
Yeah.
And the rest of this book is about them doing that very thing, saying we would rather die than let this go on. So we'll give our lives for each other and to stop him.
Yeah. Perfect. Well put.
No, I hope so. There's so much in
there.
Much
so. Yeah, there's so much in there. It's so good. It's so good. One of the surprising things is how, Dracula is himself in that first section. And then what we're experiencing is really the effects of Dracula throughout most of the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's Dracula's influence and the results of things that he's doing that are experienced by these people, but we're not experiencing Dracula himself very much.
Yeah, we only have contact with him in that first section. There's a lot of firsthand contact because of Jonathan. And then after that, there are occasional sightings or newspaper clippings will be included, which tell us something significant about him. And it isn't until toward the end when, oh my gosh, that encounter in the house, I don't know why that has never stood out to me, when the guys are like, okay, you stay here, Mina. We are going to go get him.
Yep.
And they're going to his house and they're tracking him down. I mean, these guys, they're not little academics.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good stuff. Yeah. I loved it.
Yeah. They're out there with the cross and the Eucharist and they're doing it.
And the garlic everywhere.
Yeah. The garlic. Always the garlic, which always cracked me up. At one point, this is toward the end, and Mina has been affected, and she's got the scar on her forehead, which we could talk about in a second. she's like, I've got to wear a hat or a veil because these people are so superstitious, and every time they see my face, they get this look on their face, and they start giving us with extra garlic and everything. I can't stand garlic. I hate it. This is killing me.
I remember that part, too. Oh, shoot.
I was cracking up.
I actually have the quote garlic here. It says, I believe they went to the trouble of putting an extra amount of garlic into our food, and I can't abide garlic. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that was laugh out loud funny.
You know, she doesn't even care because they're getting this weird look on their, doing the evil eye thing to them. She's like, I can't handle the garlic, man.
No more.
Yeah, this is the worst.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that made me think that there's a lot of myths and tradition in this, because I can't figure out why garlic, you know, crucifix I can understand and host I can understand and all that stuff, but why garlic? And it's like, I guess, garlic has always been associated with health and stuff. I found a thing here, but he doesn't really explain it in the book.
No.
As far as I could find.
He doesn't explain. I mean, those things are just kind of there. And so you know to do it. Because isn't it, I don't know if he says it in this book or if I'm picking up from later books where he says like hawthorn wood or there's some wood for the steak.
Yeah. It's got to be folklore, yeah.
Yeah, it's that thing, don't pick up mercury and play with it if your thermometer breaks. It's just, I don't know why, don't.
Just don't do it. Yeah, it says here, another theory is that vampirism can be seen as symbolic of mosquito bites, and garlic is known in folklore as a natural mosquito repellent.
Oh, give me a break.
Yeah, which is not as fun.
Yeah, no, I don't care.
Yeah, I was just interested because, it's like, I thought maybe there was like a sacred quality of garlic that I did not know. That's why I started looking into that. What could there be something that I, just never came across?
Garlic bread, by the way, everybody. Yes.
This garlic bread, favorite. It's burning my mouth. Did you ever see a slight digression? Major digression. But the episode of The Office that Joss Whedon directed?
No.
Yeah, you must. Yeah. Anyway, there's a little bit of vampire in that one. So it's fun. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I'm
trying to remember the name of the episode. Okay. But it actually is a really great one. But anyway, I digress.
It's interesting because some things he did explain.
Yes.
Like where the first vampires came from.
Mm.
And that's just a small thing. Let me find it here. But you kind of just feel like, oh, well, he was always a vampire. He lives forever and all this kind of thing. But in the book, I believe it's Van Helsing, is talking about the Draculas, right?
Yeah.
The Draculas were, says Arminius, a great and noble race, though now and again were scions who were held by their coevals, I don't know, to have had dealings with the evil one, and that's a capital E and O. They learned his secrets in the Skolomance, among the mountains over Lake Hermannstadt, where the devil claims the 10th scholar as his due. In the records are such words as Strioika, witch, Ordog, and Pokol, Satan in hell. And in one manuscript, this very Dracula is spoken of as a Wampir, which we understand all too well. There have been from the loins of this very one great man, men. Well, see, this is where you get Van Helsing and his crappy English. There have been from the loins of this very one great men and good women, and their graves make sacred the earth where alone this foulness can dwell. For it is not the least of its terrors that this evil thing is rooted deep in all good. In soil barren of holy memories, it cannot rest. So basically, you have, as Jim Moon said on SFF Audio when we were talking about this, you've got Hogwarts for, you know, Satan, essentially. Yeah. And that's where Dracula comes from, right? He's the 10th one who got picked. But because he comes from something that was so good, because, and we can talk about that next, is evil is a perversion of good. He has to lie in holy ground. And remember, when he says, when he is buying the house in England and they're saying, oh, it's a very old house, it has a chapel, he says, oh, that's good. I have to have holy ground nearby. Just, you know,
so I remember saying that. Yes, for sure.
Yeah. Right. And it's opposite from what we think, which is they would be in unhallowed ground. Because they're anti good. But they are going back to the roots, as this says, of he has to be in holy ground, in soil barren of holy memories, it cannot rest. And that's so opposite to what we think. But what that does is make me think of, if you'll indulge me for a second, one of the big themes of this, of course, is good versus evil. But the good is a really particular kind of good, and the evil is a very particular kind of evil, because Christ is all good in this book. That's why a crucifix, not a cross. The Eucharist specifically is used to keep vampires away, to keep them in. When Mina's turned into a vampire, or when Mina is connected to Dracula through the blood, the Eucharist touching her head scars her, burns her and scars her, because it is Christ. This book is taking transubstantiation as a real thing. There's no messing around with, it's a symbol, and if you don't believe it, won't work.
Yeah.
So Dracula is the perversion of that. Dracula, so if Jesus died and gave his body and blood so that his followers can eat it and have eternal life, Dracula kills his followers and drinks their blood so that he can have eternal life. It's the ultimate direct perversion. And all of the evil that we see in the book, when you look at what it's perverting, is something that is at its base very good and ordained by God, essentially, like marriage, the sacrament of marriage, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah, I agree with that.
And so that leads into the second big theme, which is talked about throughout the book, selfishness versus unselfishness. Because good manifests itself in unselfishness, because that's Jesus giving of himself unto the death and giving his body and blood, versus selfishness, which is Dracula, who, when he's talking about his great history to Jonathan Harker, he's bragging about the fact that, yeah, well, everybody was dying in battle and I ran away and they said it was really selfish of me. But, you know, without a leader, you can't really win. So it was okay. And he's bragging about it, but that's how he does everything.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then also the unselfishness of the group as they get together and go take care of this thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, in contrast.
Yeah, they have some really beautiful moments.
Yeah, and there are a lot of great moments amongst that group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and there are moments that you don't expect, because in a way, through her suffering, Mina is in many ways, I think, a Christ figure.
Hmm.
Because she's the one that's being held up in front of everybody to remind them of what they're there to do. I mean, she is herself. Sometimes she'll go, oh, I woke up and I thought maybe it was a terrible dream. And then I saw in the mirror, oh, no, that mark, it all happened. Because our natural tendency is to go, oh, this isn't as bad as I thought. And everybody in the book about that same time keeps like in their diary or talking to each other. They're like, oh, I thought maybe it really never happened. Oh, no. And then I saw Mrs. Harker in her scar and I remembered.
Mm, yeah, the scar on her head, right.
And then so it says they've been talking about it right after the wafer has burned Mina. And she's like, unclean, unclean, you know. And this is Jonathan Harker's telling it, but he says, then Van Helsing turned and said gravely, so gravely that I could not help feeling that he was in some way inspired and was stating things outside himself. It may be that you may have to bear that mark till God himself see fit, as he most surely shall, on the judgment day, to redress all wrongs of the earth and of his children that he has placed thereon. And oh, Madame Mina, my dear, may we who love you be there to see when that red scar, the sign of God's knowledge of what has been, shall pass away and leave your forehead as pure as the heart we know. For so surely as we live, the scar shall pass away when God see right to lift the burden that is hard upon us. Till then, we bear our cross, as his son did in obedience to his will. It may be that we are chosen instruments of his good pleasure, and that we ascend to his bidding as that other, through stripes and shame, through tears and blood, through doubts and fears, and all that makes the difference between God and man. There was hope in his words and comfort, and they made for resignation. Mina and I both felt so, and simultaneously we each took one of the old man's hands and bent over and kissed it. Then without a word, we all knelt down together, and all holding hands swore to be true to each other. We men pledged ourselves to raise the veil of sorrow from the head of her whom, each in his own way, we loved, and we prayed for help and guidance in the terrible task which lay before us.
Hmm.
And I have to say, how many times did I read that book and I never particularly noticed that passage? And it's very important.
Mm.
That's the point when they all go, okay, this we're in, no matter what.
Right, right. Yep. Yeah, that's a profound moment right there. That's amazing.
Yeah, and that direct comparison of, you know, nobody in those current contemporary reviews mentioned this stuff, because I think to them it would have all been taken as matter of course.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I really like the contrast between between that action, you know, that unselfish act, and then what Dracula is completely,
mm-hmm.
you know, which, like you pointed out, was selfishness. You know, taking in order to survive, you know, which is the opposite of what Christ is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then you got the community aspect of it as well.
Yeah, once again.
Yep.
Because when they try to go it alone and protect her, they leave Mina alone.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? They're weaker.
Right.
And she's attacked.
Yeah.
They should have taken her with them.
Yeah, and don't they watch movies? Because you don't do that.
Never go downstairs after dark.
Take everyone with you all the time.
Yes. Yeah. Don't split up.
Don't split up.
We all know this.
Yeah, we're in a haunted house. The best idea I have is that you go that way, I go this way, and you stay here. That's the perfect plan.
I know. Mm-hmm. It's like, what are you doing? Well, and the other thing that's kind of interesting is Renfield is the example of the selfishness also.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, yeah.
There's one point when he's pounding on the door and going, let me in, I've done everything for you, I want to follow you, you're the way, I want to go, and Dracula's not answering, you know. But Seward notices early on that Renfield is really selfish. Uh-huh. And then later when Renfield's banging on the door and doing that, he kind of says, oh, yeah, he's like all the people who would follow Jesus and say, well, forget about the holiness part and the signs. I want some more of that bread that you gave us. It's like, that's what he's doing.
Oh, wow.
And he's unreligious, yeah. You know, or irreligious or whatever. He's all science.
Yeah.
But it was so funny, that little remark. He's just kind of laughing at him, going, oh, yeah, the hypocrisy of the whole thing.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I loved, you know, Dr. Seward, you know, talking about Renfield all the time in his diary. It does use the word selfishness here. So the first time, near the first time, you know, it says the case of Renfield grows more interesting the more I get to understand the man. He has certain qualities very largely developed: selfishness, secrecy, and purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's interesting in light of the rest of it.
Yeah,
I wish I could get at what is the object of the ladder? What is his purpose? And he's collecting these bugs, and Seward says, you got to get rid of the bugs. And he's like, okay, 3 days, give me 3 days. And he's like, all right. And so he gets spiders. Feed spiders to the bugs. And then the spiders are getting huge. He's like, dude, you got to get rid of those spiders. Okay, I will. And then he gives him, or he gets a bird at that point, I think.
He has some sparrows. He lures them through the park.
And then he asks for a cat. Can I please have a cat?
And then he's like, no, I don't want to know what's going to happen to the cat. Or maybe he got a cat and wanted a dog or something. Yeah. I can't remember. But at one point he's like, no, we're not going there.
I don't think so. Yeah.
And sometimes he'd say, you have to get rid of these. And then all they'd find were a few feathers. And he'd like, you know, they're like, he ate them. Feathers and all. Just he like,
that bird.
Disgusting. That's why he's like, I'm not giving you a kitten. I don't want to know what you're going to do to that.
Oh, man. That's wild.
Yeah.
So when you were reading the passage, the Dracula's were, says Arminius, a great noble race, mm-hmm. you know, it mentioned this thing. They learned his secrets in the Scholomance, which is a word that I looked up because I was interested in that. But what it says here, so this is a clue to the sources of some of the stuff that he wrote this. But it says this, in Wikipedia, the Scholomance was fabled to be a legendary school of black magic run by the devil, supposedly located near an unnamed lake in the mountains south of the city Hermannstadt in Hungary.
Huh.
South of the city of Hermannstadt, and then it has some stuff in parentheses, but it says in Transylvania, right? And then mm-hmm. Below that, it says Emily Gerard, a Scottish author married to a Polish cavalryman stationed in Hungary, gave a detailed description in an article titled Transylvanian Superstitions in the magazine The 19th Century in 1885.
Huh.
Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
Yeah. So then, just a quick thing. She writes, as I am on the subject of thunderstorms, which she must have been, I may as well here mention the Scholomance, or school supposed to exist somewhere in the heart of the mountains, where all the secrets of nature, the language of animals, and all imaginable magic spells and charms are taught by the devil in person. Only 10 scholars are admitted at a time. And when the course of learning has expired and 9 of them are released to return to their homes, the 10th scholar is detained by the devil as payment. Isn't that interesting? I've never heard of that before.
No, until this book.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah. And then this Wikipedia article goes in and says, you know, where it has appeared in Dracula, it says it's twice.
Okay.
Yeah. But fascinating. It reminds me a little bit of Lovecraft's Necronomicon, right, which again was taken from something before Lovecraft, I believe.
Oh, was it?
I think so, but I guess I'm not positive.
The Mad Ali somebody.
yeah, and I know he made that up, right? He made up the origin.
Yeah.
But anyway, fascinating stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then that reminds me, again, you know, well, you talk about the pop culture stuff, but, you know, when that comes up, but, you know, in Buffy the Vampire Slayer and in other things where you've got the guy who has the books, right?
Mm-hmm.
you know, because, yeah, it's all in these ancient books. All of this ancient knowledge that we've lost mm-hmm. is where all the answers are to all this stuff.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's interesting that, you know, in the turn of the century, in the 1900s, right, 1800s to 1900s, that people were feeling that way, you know, like where we're losing a lot of the old things, right?
Yeah. Right. Just like now, really.
Just like now, exactly.
It's a very unsettled time. All this new stuff has come in. We don't know what it means. We're interested in it, but it's changing everything really fast.
Yeah, yeah. I really enjoy that aspect of this book.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and you mentioned Joss Whedon in The Office, but, you know, of course, there's Angel.
Oh, and yeah,
Angel
yeah.
Mm-hmm. is the first thing I ever watched by him that mm-hmm. I can think of.
Oh,
and,
really?
Yeah.
You watched Angel first?
Yeah, I went back to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I only got partway through season 3, which I keep meaning to finish, but I really don't like Sarah Michelle Gellar. Is that her name?
Hmm.
I really hate her. So it's harder to watch Buffy since she's Buffy. But the thing with Angel that I think back on is it's funny. He understood a real vampire is totally evil.
Yeah.
I mean, we like Spike because he's pretty cool, but he's totally evil yeah. until, of course, toward the end. But, you know, the whole curse on Angel is that he's given a soul so he can understand exactly what he did.
Right, right. Exactly how evil he was, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and try mm-hmm. to make penance for it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to look at one of these contemporary reviews.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was neat. It's in the very first one, the Daily Mail, June 1st, 1897. But it's interesting what he, actually, I'm assuming he, but it might be a she,
yeah.
Sort of compared it to.
Oh.
So he says, I'll just read the paragraph. It is said of Mrs. Radcliffe that when writing her now almost forgotten romances, she shut herself up in absolute seclusion and fed upon raw beef in order to give her work the desired atmosphere of gloom, tragedy, and terror. If one had no assurance to the contrary, one might well suppose that a similar method and regimen had been adopted by Mr. Bram Stoker while writing his new novel Dracula. In seeking for a parallel to this weird, powerful, and horrorful story, our mind reverts to such tales as The Mysteries of Udolpho,
mm-hmm.
Frankenstein, Wuthering Heights, The Fall of the House of Usher, and Marjorie of Cuther. But Dracula is even more appalling in his gloomy fascination than any one of these. So there's two there that I haven't heard of. The Mysteries of Udolpho, I don't know.
Oh, I've heard of it. Yeah.
And Marjorie of Cuther, I don't know.
Mysteries of Udolpho, you haven't heard of just because you haven't read enough gothic stuff.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, like jet hair and that kind of thing, which isn't really gothic, but sometimes they'll make fun of, oh, what are you reading? Some of that trash, you know? And her books are all set during Regency times. They're gotcha. Romances, but very mild romances, and their charm is in the humor and the personalities and the situations that these people find themselves in.
Hmm.
But they're really true to their time period. And sometimes people will be reading things like, oh, no, I have this book that's really different from these others. It's by somebody named Miss Austen. Or,
oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But and which is true now that I think about it, because hers were all anonymous. But
interesting.
Anyway.
Is Wuthering Heights, I don't know if you know anything about that.
Wuthering Heights?
Is it some type of a... It must not be what I think it is. How is it comparable to Dracula?
Well, I've never been able to finish it. I hate Heathcliff so much. Catherine's pretty terrible.
Yeah,
it's one of those really horrible. All those books are those gloomy gothic things that. And that book was written. People look at it, talk about it as a love story, but it's not a love story. It's a story about what happens when there is no love and everybody's super selfish.
Mm.
And it's terrible. I mean, what happens is terrible. And that's why I've never been able to get through it, because I hate those people so much.
Huh. Okay.
And everybody around them suffers because they're so awful.
Gotcha. Yeah. So. I remember we'd read Jane Eyre, and I can't remember mm-hmm. where in the timeline that falls.
Well, Wuthering Heights is by her, her sister.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's around the same time.
Yeah, Charlotte Bronte. And then I can't remember the name of the, which sister wrote the other one. Sorry, I should know.
No, I was just curious. You know, but it's interesting what they're comparing it to. You know, that's contemporary.
I think meaning kind of a, not only gloomy, but I don't know. They're abandoned on a heath somewhere. I mean, wherever they live is far away from everyone. So it's a real microcosm.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what they're talking about.
Right.
Maybe it just struck them that way. It was just a newspaper reporter doing a rude.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I recently watched, not because of this in any way, but I know that you've mentioned it before, but Let the Right One In.
Yeah.
That was a heck of a movie.
That understands it, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I'm looking at that, and having watched that and then read this, you know, it's definitely a direct descendant. It's in fact, they seem to understand this book more than most filmmakers because, they really followed all this stuff.
Yeah,
including the walking up the outside of a building.
Well, and that's also a good one for understanding how this book would have seemed at that time. You know, it's a very fresh take. You feel the horror of it.
Yes, yes.
Because you look at that kid's situation and you can see what's going on all around them.
Yeah.
And how awful it is.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
But she does seem to be sorrowful at doing it, right?
Oh, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, I think...
You think she's manipulative?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. I think
that's proven by the very last scene. Sorry for anybody who hasn't seen
it. Oh, okay.
I think that very last scene shows exactly how manipulative it was. Because eventually that kid's going to grow up and be just like the person just that like she ditches at the beginning.
Exactly, right. So they're like Renfield.
She's just traded out. Exactly. Yeah. She's just manipulating this kid and, destroying him. Because for her own purposes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
To me, that's the last scene was when I went, wow, this is a view of pure evil.
Mm.
In which case, it's a really good representation of Dracula.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, when she acts sorry, she's just playing the kid.
Mm-hmm,
she's got how many centuries or whatever of experience.
Yeah, she'd been 12 for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
Fascinating. Yeah. Cool. But yes, Dracula.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so, yeah, legit. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, I thoroughly liked it. So it was interesting, you know, they had 50 crates of soil that they brought over, spread all the way throughout London.
Yeah.
And then one of the things they had to do was go find them all and put a piece of host in every one of them.
His hidey holes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then, I think that's what got me when I was, Craftlit also did this, Heather Ordover at Craftlit. She had different people reading, you know, the parts. It's a really well done audiobook of it. And her commentary, you know, was pointing out how important the host was. And it was listening to that I realized when Van Helsing is breaking up the host into little pieces and mixing it up with putty or whatever to put it around the door of Lucy's tomb.
Yeah.
I had a really unexpected feeling. I felt hurt. It hit me viscerally. And I didn't expect to feel that way, but I was really like, but this is the host.
Yeah.
You can't do that. You know?
Yep.
And they're treating it that way.
Yep. It's like you're putting Christ in that spot forever.
Yeah, because that's why the host repels vampires. It is the true presence. It is Jesus. It's God himself. Yeah,
that's something else. And and they use it over and over, right? He's got some in his bag all the time, which itself is just like, what?
Exactly.
But
Hmm. Well, and there are, we were talking about current day things, and there are some ways that people like to read back into books from this time period. You know, it's the post-Freudian, we understand people's intentions, even if they didn't know what they were writing, that kind of thing. And so we like to put the things we're interested in into those books when maybe they weren't intended. And a couple of them that particularly annoy me are the idea that people who Dracula was feeding off of were sexually aroused.
Hmm.
That it's a sexual act.
Yeah, yeah.
And really what it is, it's he's nourishing himself. It's, it goes back to the feeding, you know, Jesus feeding people with his blood or Satan feeding on people's blood. And it can be a perversion, as it's used in the book, of other things. So that, but like, so when Lucy is going after the babies, it's because, you know, and Arthur reacts the way he does, it's because she would have been the mother of his children. Mm, instead, mm-hmm. she's sucking these kids' blood and just, you know, Arthur, and she just tosses the kid down like it's a sack of potatoes.
Right, right.
You know, and when Dracula is, and the reason a lot of people will say this is because when Mina goes and finds Lucy after she's been sleepwalking and Dracula's been feeding off of her outside of the old chapel or the church, you know,
mm-hmm, yeah,
in whatever that town was. You know, she's shuddering if she's cold, as if she's cold. Well, Mina had a cloak on. She was cold. She's like, I can't breathe. Right. Because she can never breathe the rest of the way through because she doesn't have any blood to carry oxygen.
Mm.
But we, and so they wouldn't have read it that way at the time. Or yeah, you would have seen it in those reviews. Going,
agreed, ah! Yeah.
And the blatant sexuality and blah, blah, blah.
Right, right.
You know, so when he's perverting the marriage sacrament, like when he's making Mina drink his blood and Arthur's or Jonathan's there and that kind of thing. And he's using marriage language even, but that's, he's perverting all the things that are good. It's, we take it and we simplify it and it turns it into something lesser than what it is. Let's see. So Mina is telling what Dracula was saying to her before he makes her drink some of his blood.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, they played, hold on, he's talking about her friends. Well, they played wits against me, who commanded nations and intrigued for them and fought for them hundreds of years before they were born. I was countermining them. And you, their best beloved one, are now to me flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood, kin of my kin, my bountiful wine press for a while, and shall be later on my companion and my helper. You shall be avenged in turn, for not one of them, but shall minister to your needs. So he then, you know, bursts a vein and makes her drink of it.
Right.
And he's perverting the marriage ceremony. That language is from marriage vows. Mm-hmm. But then mm-hmm. what he does, that's the thing. Other thing that happens in this book that I really like is evil sows its own seeds of destruction. So we're back to Lord of the Rings, right? Those basic truths.
Yeah.
Because when he binds Mina to him and says, when I say call, you will come. When I say see, you will see. Meaning she'll tell him everything because now they're bound by blood. But what he doesn't realize is that there are two times a day he's bound himself to her. She can see what he's doing and hear what he's doing.
Hmm.
And so when she's hypnotized, when she tells Van Helsing to hypnotize her, she can report on him.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and that's how they find him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool.
But anyway, so that's one of the ways that, you know, I see that and I'm just like, oh my gosh, this drives me crazy. And then the other thing is looking at it and reading it as anti-feminist, anti-female. You know, Lucy is not very effective. And of course, she's not there to fight vampires.
I'm surprised at that one. I guess I don't know that one. But Mina is very, very strong.
Well, that's the thing. And Mina's very strong, but Mina's kind of kept out of the action. So people don't like that.
I see. Mm-hmm.
She's not out there fighting with them. But what Mina's used for is so much more important. Like you're saying, she's a very strong woman. She's one of the smartest. As Van Helsing says in his way where he's like, she has the brain of a man. Sized compliment.
Brain of a man.
Yeah. And he goes, well, and this shows where his blind spots are, because he goes, you know, the good God must have given her to us at this time, because we wouldn't have understood half this stuff without her. And then he goes, now we must keep her away from everything. Don't tell her. She's a lady. She could be pregnant after all. Well, it would be too much for her.
Wow. Yep.
You know, so he's showing and the mistakes they make are because when they treat Mina like she is just a woman and not an equal partner in everything, that's when Dracula has his opening.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because at the beginning, when they're all getting together, they're like, we can't have any secrets. We have to tell everything that was in our letters and journals, even if we're, you know, like embarrassed by them or they make us sad, like, you know, Dr. Seward talking about how he felt after Mina or Lucy turned him down and all this stuff. And he says, well, no one needs to know that. She goes, no, we have to know everything. It's secrets that cause the problem.
Hmm.
And then they start keeping secrets from Mina.
Yeah, yeah.
And after that is when they go, nope, we have to tell the truth all the time now.
That was something, yeah. And then when they leave her alone, you know, like you said, yeah. So it's almost saying that you need her with you. It's like the it's a pro-feminist.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, yeah, you can't separate yourselves like that. You need everybody.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Everybody's got different skills that the whole group needs in order to accomplish this task.
Right. Right. Nifty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, you know, Quincy Morris, my hero.
Yeah. Poor Quincy.
He understands how to solve things. I have a Westchester. Anybody else want one? Okay, I have one.
In your perfect movie version, who's playing with Quincy?
I'm going to be Carl Urban,
right? Oh, too good.
Well, there are probably plenty of others.
I'm sure.
Who's praying to mine?
Oh, I love it. That is good stuff.
So for anybody who doesn't ever come to the blog, which is probably everybody, there are about three people who have come and noticed the tags that Scott puts on each entry. And some are straightforward and some are hilarious because Scott is hilarious. And there's always one about Carl Urban. And I don't remember when that started, but you know, I'm a fan.
I don't remember how it started either.
But it's so funny. And there are now two or three people who will come specifically to look and see what the tags are and what's said about Carl Urban. So, you know.
And he should have been in the book, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Quincy was in there.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
I hadn't really pictured any of these people in my head specifically, but now, okay, actors, fine. There he is.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, poor Quincy.
Oh, I know, but he gave his life, and he was self-sacrificial. He didn't care.
Yeah.
He was doing the right thing. And I have to say, the other thing that I love about this is there's something that you don't really expect. Hold on. Is the other reason maybe that Mina strikes me as being Christ-like, because for one thing, she's telling Jonathan's like, if anything happens to Mina, I'm going to turn myself into a vampire. I'm not going to let her go alone. And then later he's like, or I'm going to commit suicide, something. And she kind of knows what he's thinking because they're really close. And I feel like you can't do this, you know? And then she's talking and says, Jonathan, dear, and you all, my true, true friends, I want you to bear something in mind through all this dreadful time. I know that you must fight, that you must destroy, even as you destroyed the false Lucy, so that the true Lucy might live hereafter. But it is not a work of hate. That poor soul who has wrought all this misery is the saddest case of all. Just think what will be his joy when he too is destroyed in his worser part, that his better part might have spiritual immortality. You must be pitiful to him too, though it may not hold your hands from his destruction. And it's, they go on, and because her husband's like, oh, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And she's like, but it could be me. If this doesn't work, I could be like him. Shouldn't you know, I'd like to think somebody would do this for me. And I think about that and I go, I was so surprised at whichever time I was reading this through and noticed it and went, that's such complete mercy. You know, they know not what they do. Forgive them.
Mm.
And he does know what he's doing, but she's got pity for who he was originally. And then at the end says, it was like a miracle, but before our very eyes and almost in the drawing of a breath, the whole body crumbled into dust and passed from our sight. I shall be glad as long as I live that even in that moment of final dissolution, there was in the face a look of peace such as I never could have imagined might have rested there.
Hmm. Wow.
So even Dracula is redeemed.
Yeah.
On what level, I don't know.
Right,
but for
right.
the book, they showed him mercy because they had the right attitude. They had to stop him, but it was also the right thing to do for him as well as for all his victims.
Yeah, I remember seeing that, and I was like, well, that's interesting. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, he was trapped the whole time, and now he's released.
Yeah, so you get sucked further and further into a certain path. I mean, and he went to that school. He got picked out, and he was, you know, he was a great man. He did do a lot of things. He was, you know, horribly evil while he did them.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point, Van Helsing says, oh, my gosh, the brain, you know, he's had to have all these years to figure out what's going on and to figure out how to move to London. And he's like a young one who's becoming mature now. So we've got to stop him. He goes, but he could have been a great force for God if things had gone differently. And aren't those always the ones that Satan's going to try to get?
Absolutely. Know? Right.
You know, and you think about it and go, some of the most evil people in history, if they had used their force for good, they would have been great saints.
As can all of us, right?
Right. That's the
yeah,
thing.
That is the thing.
Every little tiny step we take where we're like, oh, I shouldn't do this, we have to try to fight it.
Yeah. Wow, this book is so not what I thought it was. It's marvelous, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
You know, so just seeing all these things that you're pointing out, I'm just, yeah, it's terrific. But, you know, it was a great story, too.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was like, it's making it sound because of what we're talking about, because of the podcast, all the stuff that has to do with, you know, faith or whatever. But it's written like a movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and imagine the epistolary stuff, you know, telling the story in letters and things turns a lot of people off. But, man, yeah, it was terrific. That, you know, if that's keeping you from reading this book, please don't let it.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. It's not like some books these days where they'll have real short chapters switching between people, which can be very action intense and really keep you going, but you're constantly having to make a mental shift. In this, he'll have good long sections, so you can really kind of sink into the person's story.
Mm-hmm. And the audiobook version that you recommended was terrific too. I listened to that.
Oh, the Naxos version.
Yes, it was great.
Yeah.
Yep. Very, very well done.
Yeah. It's just it's so vivid. I mean, it works really well in terms of taking you to the place also, because that's why Jonathan's part works well at the beginning. He's just like a travel guide.
Mm.
Oh, the quaint inn that I was in and the old lady and the costumes and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I would say that this book works particularly well on audio.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that's just perfect on audio. Really, yeah, really, because of how it's written. It's, just excellent.
Yeah, they change the voices out for each person, so it helps keep track of all of it. And you really do kind of get to know them that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I did want to say, in case you think it's just all lovey-dovey and all this kind of stuff, I wanted to read this one thing, if this is all right.
Of course,
it's an action
yeah.
scene.
Uh-huh.
This is when they're all the men are in Dracula's house. And they're all kind of in waiting for him because they kind of have an idea of what he's doing and when he'll be back. Which also this scientific thing, the timetables and everything. It says, suddenly with a single bound, he leaped into the room, winning away past us before any of us could raise a hand to stay him. There was something so panther-like in the movement, something so unhuman, that it seemed to sober us all from the shock of his coming. The first to act was Harker, who with a quick movement threw himself before the door leading into the room in the front of the house. As the Count saw us, a horrible sort of snarl passed over his face, showing the eye teeth long and pointed, but the evil smile as quickly passed into a cold stare of lion-like disdain. His expression again changed, as with the single impulse we all advanced upon him. It was a pity we had not some better organized plan of attack, for even at the moment I wondered what we were to do. I did not myself know whether our lethal weapons would avail us anything. Harker evidently meant to try the matter, for he had ready his great kukri knife and made a fierce and sudden cut at him. The blow was a powerful one. Only the diabolical quickness of the Count's leap back saved him. A second less, and the trenchant blade had shorn through his heart. As it was, the point just cut the cloth of his coat, making a wide gap whence a bundle of banknotes and a stream of gold fell out. The expression of the Count's face was so hellish that for a moment I feared for Harker, though I saw him throw the terrible knife aloft for another stroke. Instinctively, I moved forward with a protective impulse, holding the crucifix and wafer in my hand. I felt a mighty power fly along my arm, and it was without surprise that I saw the monster cower back before a similar movement made spontaneously by each one of us. It would be impossible to describe the expression of hate and baffled malignity, of anger and hellish rage which came over the Count's face. His waxen hue became greenish-yellow by the contrast of his burning eyes, and the red scar on the forehead showed on the pallid skin like a palpitating wound. So.
Wow. More.
Yeah, there's plenty of action.
Very well then, yeah. You're right, yeah. He does write it like a movie.
Yeah, and going into that house, he's talking about there were spiders, there were, things were, it was just a rat, it's okay.
Yeah.
Except that we know the rats are on his side. Wow. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's cool. All these parts that we didn't even talk about. There's a whole part told through newspaper store, or through letters about a ship.
That was really great.
Yeah, there's all these different scenes of what's going on. And, and the Blue Fur Lady, when Cockney kids are getting attacked in the London streets. And so it moves from scene to scene. The action is always going.
Yeah. It's really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Because that's why I liked it in the first place when I was young,
Yeah, I would like to reread Salem's Lot now to see if there are things there that I can pick out that are direct influences. We've already done Salem's Lot on this show. But
yes.
Yep. One of our favorite episodes.
Yes. Go look in the library and under books and you'll find it. And what was I going to say? Yeah, because one thing I can think of is he's staying in the old, is it Marston Manor or whatever?
Yeah, the Marston House, right. That's unhallowed ground.
Yeah, that's the most evil place.
Right. Yeah, but there's just so many things that happen in there that are a little bit similar, like the delivery of the coffin, right? Which is full of soil. And, them having to go around town to try to kill the vampires that are have sprouted around everywhere. That's similar. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the stuff that they use to kill them with.
Well, and in this book there are all kinds of little details of life that are kind of surprising to me, and so it's kind of fun to read it. For instance, I'm thinking of Lucy is lying in her coffin and Van Helsing has left the crucifix on her mouth, I think, so that nothing will happen. That's never really described either. We don't know exactly what is going to happen, but is it Dr. Seward, who is kind of watching, and he falls asleep, but he sees a servant girl go in quietly, and he says, "Oh, this is so great, the devotion of a servant to her mistress." Well, what they find out later is she robbed the body. She wasn't devoted.
Yep.
she was like, "No, she's not going to use this stuff." And of course, the crucifix is gone, and Van Helsing's like, "Oh, crap. Okay. Are you up for cutting somebody's head off? Because that's got to happen now."
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe this to you, but.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's those little details where I was as surprised as Seward was. I was absolutely ready to believe in the devotion to this lovely young girl who died young. And maybe she'd been extra sweet. No. I need the money.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yep, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having this.
Oh, this is
really great. Again, you know, like I said at the beginning, I'm thrilled to have read this. And
I'm so glad.
It's another one of those that goes on the shelf, the things that I'm going to revisit, because I understand now why you read it so often.
Yeah, I felt like it was, I don't know, I just guess I felt like everybody reads this book as much as I do. Mm-hmm. So I thought you were going to go, oh my gosh, how many times do I have to read this thing? So I'm glad it wasn't that
great.
Way for you.
No, not at all. It was great.
Good.
Terrific. Yep, good. You bet. Wow. So where are we headed next? And welcome to October, everybody, by the way.
Oh, yeah. That's true. I meant to say that at the beginning. We're launching in strong. The way the month falls and our timing falls, we have 3 episodes in October.
It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Colossal is next.
Next is something new.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a monster movie from last year, I think.
Okay.
And I have not seen it. Maybe.
I have not seen it, nor had I heard of it till you said, till you mentioned it.
Starring Anne Hathaway.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. It's very, very good. It's going to be interesting to talk about.
All right, cool.
And I don't think we've done a monster movie, have we?
Super 8? Is that a monster movie?
I thought of it as an alien movie.
Yeah, I guess so. Alien monster movie. Yeah. No, you're right. It's an alien movie.
Not like a Godzilla kind of a King Kong kind of a thing.
Nothing like that.
Which I can't believe we've gone this long without me picking King Kong. That is one of my top 10.
Oh. King Kong died for our sins.
He died for the love of Blue Fur Lady.
Yes. All right. Well, wonderful. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes. Thank you very much,
and
everyone.
See you in a couple weeks.
Yep. Talk to you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.